Okay, so I think we should start. Prenez vos sièges si vous voulez bien, merci. Un petit micro. Et je suis très heureux aujourd'hui d'accueillir le professeur Tecumseh Fitch, qui vient spécialement pour nous de l'Université de Vienne, où il travaille maintenant. Professor Tecumseh Fitch is one of the leading figures in the study of what's special about language and what's special about the human mind in this respect. Professor Fitch got his PhD with Phil Lieberman at MIT after studies at Brown. I hope I'm not wrong. You got your PhD at Brown, okay. Sorry for that. Perhaps his most famous writing is a paper by Hauser, Chomsky, and Fitch in 2002 in Science, which is a very big paper, a very interesting paper, a rich paper, suggesting hypotheses about human uniqueness for language. And I think it's a paper that we should still all read. It's really a dissection of how the language faculty could work and what could be the core of it and the periphery of it and what could be unique to humans and not unique to humans. So it's really a very fundamental paper that launched a new wave of studies. And you are going to tell us more now about your more recent studies in this field. Thank you very much for accepting my invitation.
Thanks, Dan. Can everyone hear me? Yes, it's a pleasure to be here at the Collège de France. It's a real honor to present to you. So what I'll do today is talk about syntax specifically, but I thought I would start out by saying a few words about more general questions in the evolution of language. So I study the evolution of language, which means that I've spent most of my career trapped between two people, Charles Darwin and Noam Chomsky. And as some of you might know, if you've read even a bit in this field, there has traditionally been a kind of antagonism between the biological approach to evolution represented by Darwin and stressing continuity and the more cognitive and computational perspective on language advocated by Noam Chomsky, which tends to see the differences between human language as the key aspect rather than the continuity with animal cognition. So I've always felt like I'm trapped between these two poles, and a lot of my career has been spent trying to bridge between them, trying to build bridges between these seemingly incompatible viewpoints. And this general approach is called cognitive biology. Our department at Vienna is called the Department of Cognitive Biology. So that stresses an evolutionary perspective on cognition as a whole. And this more specific question about the evolution of language and the biology of language is sometimes called biolinguistics, which is a term that I like quite a bit. And the whole goal now is to bridge between the insights of linguists like Chomsky or psychologists like William James and the insights of Darwin or more recent biologists like Nico Tinbergen. And it's not easy, because these two disciplines have gone their different ways. They speak different languages and use different terminology and have different underlying assumptions. So it's actually quite a lot of work to build these bridges. So when it comes to language evolution, there are many questions that one might ask. And let me just run through a few of them, maybe from the most trivial to the most difficult. Where did language evolve? Well, at this point, the data is crystal clear that language evolved in humans in Africa. And when modern humans came out of Africa to colonize the world, they brought language with them. So that's an easy one to answer. When did language evolve is a little more difficult, but at least in very broad terms, we know that it happened less than 6 million years ago, because our common ancestor that dates back to about 6 million years with chimpanzees didn't have language. So somewhere after 6 million years, and somewhere by about 100,000 years, shortly before humans emerged from Africa, and that's when we start seeing very clear signs of advanced culture in human remains in Africa. So those are not, I think, too difficult. We can argue about exactly when different things happen. Now, how did language evolve? This tends to be more of a controversy. So there are extreme viewpoints, like it was a saltation, it was a mutation that gave our species language all at once, versus a more Darwinian or gradualistic perspective that some primate communication system was gradually increased step by step until it reached the complexity of human language. I don't think either of these poles really makes much sense. I think probably the story of the evolution of human language involves both saltations and gradualism. I won't have time to get into that today. Why? So what is the adaptive function of language? This is one where people get really upset. So people really tend to have very strong feelings either that language evolved as a system of communication, probably, perhaps, with a continuity with primate systems of communication, like those we see in chimpanzees. And I think you'll have a talk by Klaus Zuberbühler in a couple weeks that will stress this viewpoint. Versus Noam Chomsky and many others have argued, no, language initially evolved as a tool for thought, and it was only secondarily that this thinking mechanism became used in communication. And I think that the adaptive function of language is clearly present in both of these. So again, this is probably too extreme an argument. So all of these are interesting questions. They won't be what I focus on today. That would be another talk. What Stan asked me to talk about is to get more concrete about what exactly it is that had to evolve in our species. So what is language that it could evolve? And this is ultimately a biological question. Why is language in our species and not in others, given that we share most of our genetic material, most of our neural structure, most of our biology is shared with other species, for example, chimpanzees, and yet humans seem to be unique in terms of language. So what is it? What defines this unique component of language that makes our species special? So one very basic starting point would be to go back to Aristotle and say that language is a system that allows us to map between any concept that we can think of via this complex spaghetti of language onto a signal. And then if someone speaks the same language, they can reverse that process and go from the signal back to the concept. Now, the key difference between language in this conception and most animal communication systems is that most animals can only convey a limited number of concepts via their communication system. So a dog's barking can convey its excitement, or maybe even more detailed information about who's coming, who's at the door. A honeybee's dance language can convey the location of flowers, but not their color, even though honeybees can see color, et cetera, et cetera. So vervet alarm calls can convey the presence of predators, but not of other things. So in most cases, most species have a limited set of concepts that they can match onto signals. And what makes us special as humans, and unique as far as we know, is that any concept that we can entertain, our imaginary future worlds, our past, falsehoods, all of that can be expressed into a signal. And I think that is, of course, at the root of our cognitive, our amazing, powerful cognitive abilities as humans. Now, it turns out that the way we do this, and this is going to be crucial in what follows, is that we build up hierarchical phrases built up from arbitrary words. That is not necessarily something that you'd have to have in a language, but just happens to be something that we do have in human language. So this is, in a sense, a rather broad and monolithic view. Another approach that we can take in defining language is to break it down into its cognitive and neural subcomponents. And this is basically the trick of modern cognitive science, to take any complex ability, whether it's symbolic reasoning or analogical thought or categorization or music, break it down into its component parts. And those are going to include things like memory capabilities for speech, our hearing and our speaking capabilities, and in the case of language, syntactic abilities pragmatic abilities, social pragmatic abilities. So all of these different components go into language as a whole and inform language as a whole. And so the game that we can now play, that I can play as a biologist, is to ask, okay, which of these are shared with other animals? And so, for example, we know that our hearing system is very similar to that of a chimpanzee or indeed of a dog or a cat. So this is not something that makes us special. This might be. Okay? So what this leads to then, what employing this approach over many species and over many years leads to, is a conception of language that for me, stresses all of the continuity. It stresses the many things that we share in common with other animals. Our ability to form concepts and plans, our ability to generate signals, so the vocal apparatus and the hearing apparatus, very similar in between humans and other species. And even within the domain of syntax, things like working memory or the ability to generate sequences are shared with other species. So I want to stress, even though the rest of this lecture is going to be focusing on differences between humans and other animals, I want to stress that my perspective and the biological perspective is to first say there's a broad foundation, there's a broad architecture of cognitive abilities that we share with other species. But then, of course, the question remains, then why do we have language and not other species? And that's where we start to ask, what are the unique or at least unusual human abilities that together make language possible? And that's what I'll be focusing on today. So, but not to forget this broad foundation. So when we ask particularly about chimpanzees, so if we ask what does our closest living relative lack, there are at least three things that I think are quite well attested that differentiate us from chimpanzees. So one of them is our capacity to generate speech sounds. No chimpanzee has ever spoken, and it's because chimpanzees don't have the proper neural connections to learn new sounds. Okay, so that's something that differentiates us from chimpanzees that's very relevant to speech, but not necessarily to syntax. In the semantic domain, it's very clear that we have an ability to read mind, we might say to read minds, and what I really mean is to build models of others' minds, and we can do that in a very rich way. I can know that you know things. That's something that doesn't seem to be present in chimpanzees. And also our very drive to communicate, our drive to share our thoughts and feelings that you can see in any three-year-old pointing at things and naming them, doesn't seem to be present in chimpanzees. But these two, the signaling and semantics aspects, these are important, but they're not what I'm going to talk about today, because in some ways the most challenging human uniqueness to explain is syntax. So the whole talk now is going to be focused on syntax, by which I mean compositional hierarchical processing, and I'll try and make that clear as we go along. Okay, so now we begin the lecture in earnest. I want to talk about syntax, so let me say a few words about what I mean by syntax. I don't mean just the grammar of language. I don't mean the preterite or the cases and inflection of specific languages. I mean a much more general capacity that we use in language, so for example, to build up phrase structures, but also we use apparently in other domains. For example, in music, there is a musical syntax that involves hierarchical structure. I think that's the clearest example of a non-linguistic domain. So my question from a cognitive point of view is, what makes up this general capacity of syntax? And I don't want to necessarily limit this to language at the outset. So now when we look at sign-trained chimpanzees, as I said, chimpanzees cannot speak, but they can learn to control their hands, and they can learn to communicate much more effectively using sign than with speech. And in the many cases in which this has been done, both in chimpanzees and gorillas, what we see are that chimpanzees can learn hundreds of either hand signs or symbols on a keyboard, and they can learn to communicate with those. But what none of these animals do is combine these symbols, combine these individual words into complex syntactic structures. So they don't build up larger and larger structures. And this has been quite well attested. Even the strongest supporter of the amazing abilities of this bonobo Kanzi, Sue Savage Rumbaugh, in this paper concluded that his grammar is at the level of a two-year-old. And that's probably a bit optimistic, given what Stan showed us about what babies can actually do. Okay, so this, again, clear difference between humans and our nearest living relatives, something that happened on our brain in the last 6 million years. So what is this something? And I think a good starting point is this quote from Wilhelm von Humboldt, one of the original linguists, and he made as a kind of offhand comment that what makes language special is that we make infinite use of finite means. So we take a finite set of words and phrases, a finite set of phonemes, and from that, we can build an unlimited set of sentences. Every one of you in this room generates a sentence every day that no one has said before, at least if you speak a reasonable amount. Okay? So this is a truly phenomenal aspect of human language, and it's something that Noam Chomsky picked up on early in his early career in the 1950s and 60s. And he realized that you could take von Humboldt's comment and actually give it some formal teeth, give it some mathematical and computational backing by using the tools of mathematics that had been developed in the 1930s, based by people like Turing, by Alan Turing and Alonzo Church and many others, and reinterpret language as, rather than, say, a set of sentences or as English or German, the language that's spoken in a particular region, rather take a more abstract idea of language, that a language involves a grammar, which is a limited set of rules, but that which can nonetheless, from those limited rules, generate an unlimited, an infinite set of sentences. Okay? And I think that was an insight at the time that pretty much everyone takes for granted today. People can argue about how formal they are or how much semantics fits into this, but this general interpretation of language as a finite grammar able to generate an infinite set of structures is, I think, very clear. And what will become clear in the course of this talk is that one of the critical differences between us and, say, a chimpanzee or a dog or a cat is that we don't just generate sequences. Of course, we do generate sequences. Every sentence that I speak is a sequence of words, and we could count the words. But what's crucial in human language is not the sequence, but rather the structure that we build on top of that sequence. So let me give you a nice example from English. You could, do the same thing in French or any other language. So here's an English sentence. The boy who kicked the dog chased the girl. And if you speak English and you're awake, if I ask you the question, who chased the girl? Everybody knows who it is, right? It's the boy. It's not the dog. But if Kanzi or some other animal was looking at this, they might say, well, wait a minute. Look, it says right here, the dog chased the girl. That they could argue with us, right? And why is it that we don't interpret that? Well, because the first thing we do to this sequence of words is that we impart a structure on it where who kicked the dog is actually just an adjective. It just basically modifies the boy. And we know, as humans, that the dog chased the girl and not. So this is an illustration of the hierarchical structure of language that is absolutely crucial to our ability to make infinite use of finite means. Because only with this kind of structure can we have reasonably short sentences that still can capture all of the different varieties of thoughts that we might perceive. Okay? So this is really going to be at the heart. This is the take-home message of today's talk, the importance of hierarchical structure. And what I want to tell you about now is how we go about searching for this kind of structure in non-human animals. So the core biological issue from my perspective, as someone who mainly works on animals, is first to recognize that humans have this capacity to deal with hierarchical structure. And you'll see, towards the end, I'll describe why this is tied in with symmetry as well. So humans also perceive symmetry and like to design things with symmetry. And my question is, what are the biological bases of this drive to perceive hierarchy and structure? And one thing that's rather interesting is that if we look in previous work in non-human animals, before people were really thinking about this linguistic structural question, there's lots of evidence that animals, and birds in particular, have problems perceiving symmetry, have problems matching one part of a stimulus to another part. So they could do it in a very limited domain, say with two feathers, with tail feathers or something like that. But when you give them arbitrary dot patterns, something that for us seems automatic, there's four dots over here and four matching dots over there, okay, there's a symmetry, turns out to be very challenging for non-human animals to recognize. So that to me is shocking. That's very surprising because it seems so basic to us. And that was one of the starting points for the research program that I want to tell you about today. So the roadmap, showing us the territory that needs to be conquered in this research program, comes from a long series of mathematical slash philosophical and now computational research initiated by people like Alan Turing and Alonzo Church at the bottom, and then culminated by Noam Chomsky in the late 1950s in what's now often called, in honor of him, the Chomsky hierarchy, or more technically, the formal language hierarchy. And I don't want to go into the details of this. It's rather complicated, and it's most of it is actually not that relevant to the kinds of problems that we ask. But the basic idea here is that we have a big circle that encloses all possible computations. That's what Alan Turing defined. So the Turing machine is a definition of anything that is computable, that any computer, existing or future, or any brain that processes information could process. So the Turing machine captures everything that we could write down in any computer program or generate in any neural tissue. At the center here, and this will be important, we have the basic sequential ordering operations that are involved in, say, counting from 1 to 10, or stringing words together, or stringing barks together if you're a dog. So these are called finite state grammars, FSG. And they're the base level. They're the kind of the simplest thing that you can think of that in principle can generate infinite sets. So, and this is something that we already had good evidence that animals could do. And what Chomsky defined were the two things in between, which are called context-free grammars and context-sensitive grammars. In a sense, it doesn't really matter what the difference is. What is important is that lots of work in computational linguistics has shown that human languages, the syntax of human languages, is basically straddling that divide between context-free grammars and context-sensitive grammars. So that's where we can start off with. We know we're there, and then the question becomes, where are animals? One of the reasons that this is such a powerful tool is that this is not just an abstract philosophical mathematical thing, but it's been put to use by computer scientists as a tool for thinking about computation. And the reason is that each one of these levels of the formal language hierarchy corresponds to a particular kind of computing machinery. So if we want to actually go and build a computer, the first thing we can ask is, where does the processing problem lie in this formal language space? And then we know what we have to build in. Into our cell phone or our CPU and our laptop. And I will only talk, for the rest of this, I'm really only going to be talking about this, the move from this to this, because this is where we know animals are, and I'll show you lots of evidence to support that. And out here is where we know humans are. So this is really the key distinction between the so-called regular machines, these finite automata, and everything beyond that. That's going to be the crucial question that I'm asking of animals. And so let's just look inside one of these abstract computing machines that computer scientists use to get a sense of what they're talking about when they talk about a computing machine can do X and not do Y. So here's a very simple finite state automaton. And the reason it's called finite state is that there's a limited number of states. And what this machine can do is take input, say read input from a tape, and with each input, it can step from one state to the next. And it's only got a limited number of those states. It can step back. It can go in circles. But all it can do is go from state to state, and if an input comes in that it doesn't recognize or that it can't get to another state from, it crashes. It fails. Okay? And then it would output a no. But if it can read through a tape and step from state to state and accept that, then it will output a yes. Okay? So that's the basic problem, and that could be calculating whether a number is prime or calculating whether a sentence is well-formed, calculating whether a string of letters is a word in English or in French, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's many problems that you can solve with this kind of system. All we need to add to this to get this rich, hierarchical, supra-regular, so beyond this finite state system, is a very simple thing, a stack. So this is the basic idea, and this was Chomsky's innovation, that even a very limited form of additional memory, additional to this finite set of states, is enough to allow you to solve a whole set of problems that can't otherwise be solved. So for example, in mathematics, we have parentheses, and you can have multiple parentheses within parentheses. That's something that we take for granted in written mathematics or even in written language. That's something you can't solve with one of these finite state machines, but you can solve with one of these higher level. This would be an example of a context-free machine. And notice that it's just a finite state machine with an additional source of memory. And I think that's critical to understanding, to bridging the gap between a gradualistic Darwinian perspective, where lots is shared with animals, and the fact that language is unique to our species. So let's just say a few words more about this superregular, the things beyond the regular grammars, the finite state grammars. So these were proposed as models of language because they could see that finite state machines were too weak, but Turing machines were too powerful. They have lots of different names. At the time that Chomsky introduced them, they were called phrase structure grammars. Some people call them constituent structure grammars. But the key thing, the critical thing, is that all they are is a finite state machine with an additional stack. And a stack just means a memory that you can only read off what you last put on. So imagine cafeteria trays. You can put a tray on, and then you can only take that tray off. If you want to take a tray three things down, you have to take all the trays off, get that one, put them all back on. Okay? So it's very limited, and yet quite powerful. Now, Chomsky in the early days was collaborating with this guy, George Miller, a psychologist. And what Miller did, it's a great paper, I recommend it. It's called Grammarama. And the idea is that it's this kind of wild party of grammars where you bring in Harvard undergraduates who will do anything for 5 years, or in those days they'd probably do anything for a dollar in 1967. You sit them down in front of a computer and you give them some kind of arbitrary grammar, arbitrary formal structure with no meaning, just a sequence of letters, say. And they see these letters and they have to say yes or no. They have to play the role of one of these accepting machines. And basically you give them feedback, and they learn whatever that grammar is. And now you can probe what they've learned by asking them tricky questions and see whether they really learned the grammar or they just learned some kind of trick. And what Miller found, in short, is that humans are very good at learning they can learn both finite state grammars and context-free grammars, but in the case of context-free grammars, they seem to find it more natural. Are more natural, easier to cope with than regular languages. They're easier for people than the left-to-right sequential organization characterized by regular grammars. Okay? And what also was very interesting is that even if you give humans something that was generated by a sequential finite state grammar, what they nonetheless infer are higher level grammars. They infer hierarchy that in some sense wasn't even there. It's almost like we have an illusion of a hierarchical structure that wasn't there. So if for those of you who are familiar with modern statistics, in Bayesian terms, we could say that humans have a very high prior on tree-like structures, on context-free structures relative to regular structures. So wherever we can, we're going to see a tree-like structure rather than just a sequence. So when we go back to the animal question that I started with, we can make this a little bit more concrete by saying humans are biased to perceive tree structures. That's Miller's insight. And now the question is, what about other species? And that's what the rest of my talk is going to be about. So this is just a visual version of the same question. We know where humans are. Where are other animals? And in my lab, we work with a wide variety of species, both smart and dumb. We work with smart primates and not-so-smart primates. We work with very smart birds like these ravens and not-so-smart birds like pigeons. And our real goal is to build a phylogeny of cognitive abilities so that we can start to say where, when, and how did particular abilities in animals evolve. Now, the first question you might ask in terms of answering this question is, let's look at animals' own vocalizations. Let's look at their communication system. And the best characterized animal communication systems that we have that at least have a hint of hierarchy are birdsong. Birds, of course, learn their song, and they make, in some species, very complex songs. And at least to a human ear, some of these songs seem to be sort of hierarchical. But if you look at it computationally, and a recent paper by Kazuo Kanoya and his group did, all the currently well-studied species can be captured by a finite state grammar, by a regular grammar. So there's no evidence that these birds go beyond that. I still think this is an open question. Whales have very interesting and complex songs. There are other birds that haven't been very well studied, like mockingbirds, which make incredibly complex songs. So I think it's still too early to say that no animal song has these characteristics, but the current data doesn't support the idea that they do. So what we have to do, though, is realize that it's very possible that a species could perceive tree structures, even if it doesn't happen to produce those in its output. And so we don't really want to just study what they do. We want to ask, what are they capable of doing with or without training? And so what we're really talking about now is animal pattern perception. So can animals perceive the kinds of structures that have tree form? And the key idea here, I'm going to give you an example to wake everyone up, is that we can do this by testing subjects with pairs of grammars. So we're going to take, for example, one grammar at the finite state level and another grammar at the context-free level. And we'll try and match those grammars as much as we can. Same length, same kinds of sequences, same domain, same feedback, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then what we're looking for is either they succeed in both grammars, in which case we go to the next set of grammars, we make it a little bit harder, or if they fail at both grammars, we go down a level and we make it simpler. Okay? So that's all of the experiments that I'm going to talk about are based on this basic idea of pairs of grammar. And there's two different techniques that have been widely used. One is called artificial grammar learning, and I'll illustrate that in a second. It's quick and easy, and it gives you a sense of what animals can do spontaneously. This is much more work. Operant testing can take many months or even years of the animal's time, putting it in a box every day, but I'll get at some operant results in a second. But let's start with the easy one, artificial grammar learning. So I'm going to do an experiment on you. This is a mock-up of what we do with our humans or our animals. I'm going to give you some examples. The basic idea is that first you expose your subject to a set of examples, strings, valid strings. And next, you probe them with new examples to see what they've learned from the previous exposure. Okay? Everybody ready? So here comes your first exposure, your first data. Sap goes to saplar. Okay? Son goes to sonlar. And some of you may be thinking, I've already got the rule, but wait, it's more complicated. Dev goes to devler. Okay? And gul goes to guler. So there's your four data points. In reality, we would do this hundreds of times. We would show a lot more data. But because I think you're all very clever, I'm going to just do it with four examples like that. And now, that was the exposure phase. I haven't told you anything. We've just seen some data. And now I'm going to probe you with some new examples that you haven't seen before. And I'll even give you a little cheat sheet up there so that's you have perfect memory. Okay? Are you ready? Novel thing one, kan. Is it kanlar? Raise your hand. Or kanler? And please, those of you who speak Turkish, don't. Okay, well, you were mostly right. Kanlar is the correct answer. What about duz? Duzlar? Duzler? God, you guys are good. You must be linguists, okay? Well, congratulations. You've just mastered something that's basically a mock-up of Turkish vowel harmony without speaking a word of Turkish, except I heard some Turkish speakers in the front. This is how artificial grammar learning works. It has nothing to do with meaning. So these are Turkish words that have meaning, but it's kind of irrelevant to the question. The question is, can you pull out a pattern from these words? And indeed, as you saw, you could, because you all got it right. Just like a Turkish baby at about age one would, okay? So how do we do this to get at this bigger question about hierarchy? Well, again, we start with a pair of grammars, in this case, a simple finite state grammar, and this is one. These are two grammars that have been used a lot in this research. So you'll see this one called AB to the N, and all that means is AB, 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 as many times as you want. So just A after B, B after A. And this is the more interesting one. This is the context-free grammar, which involves having a matching number of A's and B's. It's called A to the N, B to the N, because if there's three A's, there have to be three B's. If there's four A's, there have to be four B's. If there's one A, there has to be one B, okay? And this can be proved. This grammar can be shown to not be computable by any finite state machine, at least if N can go on forever. And in the case of these experiments, we just ask whether a species can generalize to new N's that it hasn't been exposed to. And as I said, these grammars have been looked at in many species in many different contexts. This was the first grammar that I worked with. So this is something that we did when I was at Harvard. This is a paper with Mark Hauser with humans and monkeys. And what we did is we first asked both of them to identify a set of A, B, N strings. And then we asked a different subset to identify a set of A to the N, B to the N strings. And what we found is that for humans, and so we expose and then we ask them, is this a good example or not? Just like the experiment I showed you before. And for humans, either of these grammars, either the finite state or the context-free, were equally easy. They could say that's a violation and that's not. For the monkeys, they had no problem with the A, B to the N, with the simple finite state grammar, so they were also able, by their looking, to show that they recognize violations. But no matter how we tried, we couldn't get them to do that with the A to the N, B to the N. And it's crucial to know that this is not because monkeys can't count. You might think, oh, well, if they can't count to three, monkeys can count to three. That's been shown in many other experiments. Indeed, all of the animals that I'm going to talk about can count to three or four. So that's not the problem here. The problem is something about counting, holding it in memory, and comparing to a second count. Okay? So this has turned out to be a rather consistent result. We've had the same result in multiple primates and in some birds. Our conclusion from this was very limited. We said tamarins are unable to process a simple phrase structure. People have often interpreted this in terms of showing that animals don't have recursion and much broader, much bigger claims than this. This is all we claimed from that. And of course, the question is not just about one species of monkey, but rather in general about other animals. And so very, very pleasingly for me, this has been followed up by many other experiments in humans, in animals, using neuroscientific techniques or not. And I won't have time to go through all of them. But one thing I can say is that the literature is a bit of a mess. So if you went out and started to read these papers, you might get very confused because people are often talking about recursion when they mean superregularity, or they're talking about A, B to the N, but they only use a fixed N. So there's a lot of problems with this literature. But the take-home message, at least from my perspective, is that in humans, there's no doubt that it's true. Not only can humans do this particular superregular grammar, A to the N, B to the N, but they can do lots of other superregular grammars as well in the same kind of context. So people are good at this, just as Miller found back in the 60s. The fact that animals can do various finite state grammars has also been replicated repeatedly. But the key thing that has not been convincingly shown is whether any animal that has been tested can go beyond the regular level, can do superregular hierarchical type grammars. I'll just give you an example of another finite state grammar that animals can do. So these are two of my PhD students who worked in two different species. The grammar is a very simple one. It's called A, B star A. It means start with an A, and then as many Bs as you want, and then end with an A. Okay? And what's interesting about this grammar is that you have to remember what A was at the beginning and the end. So all you have to do is have an A in the beginning and the end, and however many Bs you want. And both squirrel monkeys and chimpanzees can do this in both the visual and auditory domains. The most interesting paper in terms of evidence for animals being able to do a phrase structure or superregular grammar is this paper by Tim Gentner that was published shortly after ours in Nature. And they looked at these birds, which are starlings, very smart, very interesting, complex singing birds. And with very intensive training in an operant setup, and I'll explain what that is in a moment, these starlings seemed to be able to learn the A to the N, B to the N grammar. And this was very exciting because that would mean, if it were true, it would mean we have an animal model where we can actually put neurons, put electrodes into their neurons to look at this, the basis for this hierarchical structure. But not long afterwards, this critique came out from some Dutch workers, Carolyn van Heiningen, Carlton Kate, Jelle Zeidema, and others. Based on these little birds, these are zebrafinches, which are actually not famous for having complex song. They have a very boring, very simple song. And what these guys showed, using exactly the same setup as the Gentner et al. Experiment, is that zebrafinches seem to be able to solve the A to the N, B to the N problem, to go beyond regular, but that's only an illusion, because it's only if you lump all of the zebrafinches together that it looks like they can pass all the tests. But if you look at any individual bird, what you find is that each one of them has a trick. They always have some kind of trick, and they always fail on certain of the trick questions. So basically, what they concluded is that because the Gentner et al. Study combined all of their birds, the Dutch workers concluded that basically the Gentner result does not hold up because they pooled these individual results. So in other words, you have to separate what the group seems to be able to do from what individual birds can do. And Gentner and his colleagues have never responded convincingly to this study. They've never issued a reanalysis of the individual starlings. And so I think, basically, from my perspective, this challenge has gone through, and the Gentner results need to be taken at least with a big grain of salt, if not forgotten. So what we have from all of this auditory work is a pretty clear picture. Humans are good at doing hierarchy, just like Miller said, and animals are not. And even with intensive training, so we're talking about 50,000 trials that these starlings went through, individual birds still don't pass this very simple test, something that you all would get in 5 minutes. Okay? So one of the problems with this whole body of research is that it uses sound. It uses acoustic data. It uses sounds, either human speech or animal sounds, say bird songs, to build these structures, these strings of A's and B's. And what that means, of course, is that by the time you get to the last B, you could have forgotten, if you don't have a good auditory memory, you may have forgotten what was the first A. So this is an issue that many people have brought up, and so in the work I want to tell you about now, we try and get beyond that. Another problem with the auditory data is, what do you use as sounds? So the traditional thing is to either use human sounds, human speech, which you might say is a disadvantage for the animals, or to use animal sounds, which would be a disadvantage for humans, though we've done these experiments and humans can do it just fine with raven calls. But the problem with using animal calls is that very often the species, in our experiments anyway, they get very upset and excited when they start hearing all these vocalizations from unseen conspecifics blasted at them. So we've decided that these kind of auditory, except with musical stimuli, these kind of auditory experiments might put animals at an unfair disadvantage. So, but here's just a visual version of what we have so far based on the auditory grammars. And here's the kind of grammars that we've been working with in my lab for the last, say, 4 years. What we've done now is we've replaced these sounds with these visual tiles. So simple, meaningless. They're complicated enough that they have a lot of structure. We can generate lots of different examples of them. And as you can probably see, the A's all have certain things in common. They're all kind of grid-like and angular, whereas the B's all have certain things in common, their color and their shape and a kind of circular aspect. But there's still, we can generate very large numbers of these things. And so what we've done is, and the crucial thing is that we can present these stimuli all at once. So now you don't have to remember what the first A was when you get to the last B. You can just look. Okay? So it's only as long as it takes you to move your eyes back and forth. So this drastically reduces the working memory load of these kinds of experiments. But we were really hopeful that this would make it possible for at least some animal species to solve this task. We work with two different species, pigeons, which need no introduction. You can walk outside and see them on the street. These guys, maybe many of you don't know, these are very smart parrots from New Zealand. They're called kia. They're one of the more basal parrots, and they're famous in New Zealand for their intelligence, doing things like figuring out how to pluck sheep's skin and drink their blood when they're hungry, or peel the, you know, tricking cats and dogs, et cetera, et cetera. So New Zealanders will tell you how these are the smartest birds on the planet. And actually, in the lab, so we have the world's largest collection of kias in our lab, they are very smart. They're very good at technical intelligence. So we were at least hopeful with these guys, if not particularly optimistic about the birds. And all of these experiments were done in an operant setting where the bird or the human has the same task. They're given, first they're exposed to a set of stimuli that are grammatical, and then they're given a choice. They're given two stimuli, and they have to peck or press on the one that matches the one they saw before. Okay, and if they press on that, they get, in the case of the birds, a food reward, or in the case of a human, an increase in their monetary reward. If they fail, lights go off, screen turns red, and they don't get any reward. And then crucially, the same pair appears again. So they get another chance at it. So they keep having to do it until they finally get the answer right. Okay? So we thought, this is gonna, if they can do it, they'll be able to do it in this context. We've made it as easy as possible. Now, it's crucial, before I get to the results, it's crucial to recognize that there's some tricky empirical issues in terms of saying whether an animal actually got the context-free or super-regular grammar. And this is really the central question. A set of strings that I produce in my computer or in my head using a context-free grammar might still be detectable by a simple finite state grammar using some kind of trick. So let me just give you an example. So for A to the N, B to the N, we have, say, strings of 2As and 2Bs, 3As and 3Bs, 4As and 4Bs, okay? So one trick to recognize those as opposed to AB, AB, AB would be to just say, does it start with 2As, okay? Does it have a BA transition? Because A to the N, B to the N never has a transition from B to the A, et cetera, et cetera. And so you can think of many such possible examples, and I'll tell you how we can deal with that computationally in a second. But the key point is that we have to exclude those dirty tricks. If we really want to know that the animal got it, we have to show that they're not doing one of these tricks, okay? And so in the case of these particular birds doing this these two particular grammars, so they're always faced with an A to the N, B to the N, and an AB, AB stimulus, almost always. The first question we want to ask is, can they go beyond the N that they've seen before? So if we train them with N equals 2 and N equals 3, can they go to N equals 4 and 5? Okay, it's one basic thing. But crucially, they also have to be able to reject things that are not matched. So let's say I have 3As and 4Bs. That doesn't fit. And you as humans would say, yep, that doesn't fit. That's what we need to see the animals doing as well. And also, we want to show that they can generalize to novel stimuli that they've never seen before. What happens if we take the color away? What happens if we put a new tile in that's the same family but they haven't seen before? Those novel stimuli are also important. That's something that our animals don't seem to have much problem with. Okay, and another crucial thing is that in the case of the humans here, we did not use language to instruct them. We basically brought our humans in, said good morning, sat them down, and said, figure it out. And sometimes they'd go, wait, what do you mean? What do I have to do? And we just say, figure it out. So as long as they can use a mouse and click on the yes and no button, that's what they have to do. We don't tell them there's a pattern. We don't tell them there's any kind of grammar. We don't tell them anything about what the experiment is about. They have to figure it out themselves, just like our animals, just like our birds do. Okay? So when we look at the humans, what we see is basically they're performing at ceiling. They're getting all of the novel stimuli, novel colors, novel rotation, grayscale stimuli, scrambled stimuli, extensions, no problem. The only one place where we occasionally have people messing up is where we have those three N's and three A's and four B's. Most humans, 8 out of 10 in this context, significantly reject those. But occasionally people say, I don't know, why? Why should I reject? You know, nobody told me there's supposed to be a matched number. So occasionally, say 1 in 10 people will accept those. Okay? But basically what we see is for both grammars, humans are performing at ceiling. Now let's look at the birds. So first of all, the novel stimuli. New tiles that they've never seen, no problem. New color schemes that they've never seen, a little more difficult, but they can do it. Rotating the stimuli, not a problem. Removing all color, that posed some real problems. The pigeons never got that, so when we do the novel colors, the pigeons basically are a chance. The kias can do that, though it was hard for them. We had to give them a little extra training. But now, so yes, they can generalize. They generalize quite nicely. Now here are the two other crucial tests. So what we have now are, first of all, the extensions. So they've been trained on N equals 2 and 3, and now they're exposed to N equals 4 and 5. Kias, no problem. The pigeons, yeah, they're over chance. They're just above chance, but not very far above it. So some pigeons get that and some of them don't. But now, critically, when we look at these foil stimuli, the ones where the A and the B don't match, they're at chance. So this was with a method called probe stimuli where we don't reward them. So they might have looked and said, well, I don't know. I don't have any prior evidence, just like some of our humans did. So then in the case of the kias, we actually gave them training where they were given a choice between a matched and an unmatched stimulus. And even with weeks of training, these birds, these very smart birds, still couldn't do that. So this is back to the symmetry that I talked about at the beginning. So this was a really shocking and, I can tell you, disappointing result, certainly for our kia people. They were really depressed after 6 months of work to find that the birds weren't doing it. What are they doing? Well, in some ways, they turn out to be pretty smart. So I'm going to focus on the kias now, not on the pigeons. The pigeons failed a lot of things, so let's just talk about our smart birds. So the approach that we took to looking at what each individual bird learned is an approach called maximum likelihood. And so going back to this idea that there are many different tricks that you could use to do pretty well, to get food rewards most of the time. Here's a set of different tricks. So it starts with AA. We call that AA star. That would get some stimuli and not others. Ends with BB. That would get some stimuli and not others. And so we build up a large library of these kind of possible algorithms. And then we ask for each one of our stimuli, which one fits. And crucially, then for each individual bird, we can say, what did it do with that stimulus? Did it say yes or no? And so that allows us to build a picture of what's happening in the individual bird's brain. And I just want to give you a nice example. If you look at the pigeons, they are all over the place. Each bird has its own idiosyncratic approach. It's really not doing very well. It's trying things out. But if we look at those kias, they're actually really, they're very consistent. They get something quite early on. It works well enough, and it only breaks with these foil trials. And every single bird does the same thing. Okay, and in this case, it's basically just look for a BA transition. Just look for one of those transitions. So they're focusing on a very clear difference between these two grammars. But once they focus on that, they can't get out of it. They can't look at the whole global stimulus. Okay. And the data, this is for the AB to the N, but there's similar data for the A to the N, B to the N. If we have time, I'll talk about that at the end. But the crucial point is, why don't humans think of that? That's a much better solution. That's a much simpler solution in a computational sense. So the kias are smart. And the question is, why do we jump to these conclusions that the number of N and of A's and B's must match? Okay. So this is where these results have really driven home to me what seems to be a really critical difference between our species and other species, even these really smart birds, even which in some sense, from a reinterpretation, are more clever than our undergraduate subjects. So neither our not-so-clever pigeons or our large-brained kias were able to get the super-regular grammar, even when we gave them specific training with it. And this is consistent with what I told you before about their inability to match two parts of a visual stimulus, so a bunch of dots over here and a bunch of dots over there. So this actually fits into a bigger picture about animal cognition and animal perspective, or animal perception, about a problem with groups, grouping things together and matching different parts of those groupings. And of course, it's also consistent with the current failure of primates on the same kinds of tasks. So here's where we stand. Here's our current state of the art. Lots of animals can do finite state grammars, as can humans. There are only a few possible indicators. I'm being rather polite by putting a question mark there for the starlings, but there may be other species out there that can go beyond the regular level, and humans very clearly, no problem, go beyond it. So this has led to what I call the dendrophilia hypothesis. So the basic idea is that we as humans are unusual because we love trees. And I don't mean we go and hug actual trees. I mean that we look at our world and we try and build hierarchical structures. And you see this in architecture. You hear it in music. You see it in our social structures, our hierarchical social structures. But you really see it very clearly and strongly in language. So the basic idea is that this is a species typical. It's something that we are unusual in as humans, but it's domain general. It spans across all of human cognition. It's very powerful in language, but it's not limited to language. And the crucial thing here is that we can infer these tree-structured hierarchical structures from patterns. And this, from a computational point of view, means that we need to go beyond a simple finite state grammar. Okay? So now I want to come back in the end, in the last few slides, to what I think in the brain is actually going on here. So what everything I've told you about is basically a diagnosis of the phenotype. It's just looking at what organisms do from a behavioral point of view. But of course, the million-dollar question, or million-euro question, is what happened in our brains? What's special about our brains? And here, I think there's a pretty reasonable hypothesis that's out there. I think it's consistent with a lot of data. Okay, and then I want to just say a few things about how we can go further with this approach before I end. So remember that what we need to go beyond a finite state grammar is we need a computational resource, a particular kind of memory, in addition to that set of finite states in the machine. And in a case of a context-free grammar, that's called a stack. There are other forms of grammar. The exact nature of that, other forms of memory, exact nature of that memory is not the crucial issue. That there is some auxiliary memory is the critical thing. So the finite state grammar, as it steps through a sequence, needs to be able to put things aside and then come back to them later. In the same way that if you're cooking and you're in the middle of chopping the onions, the phone rings, you go and you answer the phone. Then the doorbell rings, you answer the door. Then you go back to your phone call, then you go back to chopping onions. And that requires a kind of stack. It requires you to remember what you were doing and then finish that job up. So what I'd like to propose, and this is not my idea, I think it's a pretty widespread idea, is that in general, the frontal cortex, the prefrontal cortex, plays that role in animal cognition. It plays the role of an additional memory that keeps the bigger picture in mind as other parts of the brain process detailed sequential information. And there's lots of evidence from this, from brain imaging, from details of track tracing. I won't go into all the details. But I do want to call your attention to a particular region of interest. And this is an area called Broca's area. People argue about exactly what it is, but we'll say area 44 and 45 and maybe a little of 46 or 43. But basically, this prefrontal region, it's right about here in your own brain, which was identified by the famous French neurologist Paul Broca because its destruction led to a loss of language in his first patient. So this area has been the focus of a lot of attention. What we know from neuroanatomical data is that this is the most enlarged region of the human brain. So of all the areas that have been compared between humans and chimpanzees, and this is very hard work, this is Natalie Schenker's work, going through multiple slices of chimpanzee brains and going in detail through the cytoarchitectonic areas so that you can now say how big is Broca's area in a chimp and how much bigger is it in humans. And the answer is 5 to 6 times bigger. Our Broca's area is 5 to 6 times larger than the corresponding area in a chimpanzee. And just to give you a sense, okay, our brains are bigger. Well, what about primary visual cortex? Well, that's only 1.8 times larger in humans than in chimpanzees. Okay? So this is a hugely expanded part of our brain. It's something that's present in chimpanzees, but it's not as big. So that's part one. We expanded that part of the computer. But the second thing is that we also connected it much more intensively with other parts of the brain. This is work done by Jim Rilling using the technique that Stan mentioned called DTI, so basically looking at white matter connections between parts of the brain. And what Rilling found is that if you look in chimpanzees, in monkeys, there's basically only these kind of ventral connections between the temporal cortex and the prefrontal cortex. Whereas in human beings, we have a very intensive arcuate sulcus, which connects via a dorsal pathway all of these temporal regions and parietal regions with a large area of prefrontal cortex, including Broca's area. And chimpanzees are somewhere in between. They've started to get these dorsal connections, but they don't really come down into temporal cortex. So those two things combined, bigger area and more connected area, seem to provide Broca's region with its reason for existence. And so the hypothesis is essentially that Broca's area on both sides, on the right side and the left side, because the right side is very involved in music syntax, the left side more in linguistic, is that Broca's area acts as the stack. So as the rest of the brain sequentially processes information, say coming in through the auditory cortex for speech or the occipital cortex for sign, it's Broca's area that keeps track of these long distance connections of phrases that have not yet been finished. And some evidence for that actually comes from Stan Dehaan and Christophe Pallier. I think this is a really nice experiment. It's not the only experiment by any means, but I think it's in some sense the cleanest experiment. And what they did is they used Jabberwocky, which is kind of nonsense speech, but embedded in a syntactic frame. And they increased the chunk size so that some were two word phrases, 3 word phrases, 4 word phrases, 6 word phrases. And what they found is that these particular regions, so the inferior frontal gyrus, that's basically Broca's area, were selectively engaged, even in the Jabberwocky, where there wasn't any meaning. So it's crucial that meaning is being held to one side here. This is about syntactic complexity. And as the chunk size increased, as the size of the hierarchical structures increased, you get more and more activation in these regions. So in the two shown in blue. Okay, so this is consistent with lots of other data. Since people had brain imaging, they've been asking this question, how does syntactic complexity, what does it do in the brain? And the answer is almost always that it increases activation in Broca's area. Okay, so I just want to end by saying you might think this computational model that I've been talking about is a little limited, and I agree. It's only talking about form. It's not talking about meaning. It's really talking about these meaningless strings, whether they're tiles or syllables or whatever. It's just, in a sense, a string or a stimulus that cannot engage your mind at a semantic level. And I think that's important because that allows us to separate out questions of semantics and syntax. And I do think that ultimately what we want is we want to have a theory of computation that is really tailored to how actual brains actually work. And when we have that, I'd be happy to throw out my stacks and my finite states, et cetera, et cetera. But right now, the only model of computation that we have that can really map on to stimuli in a way that we can put to work as experimentalists is the one that I've told you about today. So I do see that the goal of this research program before I die will be to replace this with something more neurally plausible. But I think at present, this is the best we've got. And I hope to have shown you today that, in fact, it's not so bad. It's a good place to start. So just to conclude, I hope you can see that we can study language and even syntax, which is the most special thing that we've got, from a comparative viewpoint with studies with animals. I think syntax is hard, but it's not that syntax came out of nowhere. It's certainly built on things like working memory and sequential abilities. And finally, my hypothesis coming out of all this work is that the crucial difference between our syntactic abilities and those of other species is this dendrophilia, this desire to find tree hierarchical structure in non-human species. And I should end by just thanking the key people who did this work. So a PhD student at the time, Geisha Westphal-Fitch, Andrea Ravignani, who was a PhD student, and Uli Aust, who was a postdoc, and a big team of master students and PhDs, and funding from the ERC and my home university. And thank you very much for your attention.